information, visit cinemagallery.cc, Champaign County, and or follow Cinema Gallery on Instagram. So what have I got today? There's so much, obviously, as I always lament, may you live in interesting times. The curse from China. I wish it was dull, but it's not. Mumia Abu-Jamal's having eye problems. For a prolific writer like him, not getting his eyes treated is cruel, unusual punishment. It seems to me he put up something specific to his own case and then a shorter piece, more general, about other people that are in his situation of low medical care, incarceration. So I'm going to play a short one first. Maybe there'll be time for the longer one. You can find it at prisonradio.org. Amy Goodwin's got one on the anniversary of Katrina. She did a fair amount on that this week. I'm going to try and do something I don't generally do, which is play from a YouTube. I didn't have time being insomniac last night. I didn't get up early enough to dub this to a source where I could control it more. Greg Palast has a new hour-long piece called All Washed Away, where he talks about Kerrville, Texas, but of course in the context of the anniversary of Katrina drowning New Orleans. The Big Uneasy is back out there from satirist Harry Shearer. It's quite good. It didn't have a very good turnout for its showing here when it was first released, maybe a couple years after Katrina hit. But it's worth your attention. I think it's free online now. It goes into the background and how it was an accident of the engineering. But this guy, Palast, is more onto the oil industry's role in tearing up something he said that I don't know. Bayous aren't a natural phenomenon. Bayous are from oil, quote, development. It was a swampy wetland where cows grazed before it started becoming bayous. I don't know. I should fact check that, I suppose. In the second half, I'll be playing Rashid Holiday. I did play it last Sunday, but it's so cogent and so important. Something else I have is from Code Pink Radio, Educators for Palestine, a group inside the NEA that's working on bringing some real education. This is in the context of the rally that's happening tomorrow up on Prospect and Market View. Harkens back to the old days when Iraq War rallies were up there. Problem with parking. Hashtag Sail to Gaza and the Global Samud Flotilla. They may list demonstrations around the state. Let's get specific. There's a poster making at the Champaign Public Library, room 215, 1 to 3 tomorrow to get ready for that rally. Boats are sailing to Gaza to deliver medicine and food. Bring your drums, voices, Palestinian flags, and signs to support this humanitarian mission. Hashtag sail to Gaza. Okay, that'll be the second half hour, so let's get it started with Mumia Abu-Jamal. And then Amy Goodman's Katrina, and then I'm going to try and interrupt any ads that inflict upon it from the YouTube screening All Washed Away, Greg Palast, if you want to see the whole hour. Repackages some of the material he did contemporaneously, a long piece he did for Democracy Now! Is excerpted. Again, Amy Goodman did some great work on it this week, and including some outtakes she has right here in her Breaking the Sound Barrier essay.
When we shine that bright light, we will symbolically, literally, and figuratively open the eyes of many. And there are guys walking around right now who have glaucoma, who have eye damage, who have lens damage, who have retinal damage due to diabetes. All of that can be treated, can be cured, or at least held at bay for a pittance. You know, laser surgery is about $7,000, right? And we've been waiting 8 months. It could have been, you know, $1,000 a month, you know, on layaway and taken care of months ago, and it wouldn't be a problem, right? But when you wait, things get worse. And that, I think, goes back to the question of a medical model. We need to question the medical model. And, you know, the job of healthcare in these vast institutions amidst mass incarceration is not to make money for private companies, but to serve the health needs of men who cannot have their health needs served by anyone else. They shouldn't be profiteering. They should be serving the health needs of this aging population. And so when we shine that bright light, we will symbolically, literally, and figuratively open the eyes of many. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
20 years later, the lessons of Hurricane Katrina go unheeded. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. It's been 20 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall on August 29, 2005, breaching New Orleans' protective levees, unleashing unprecedented destruction. It was one of the deadliest natural disasters in U.S. history, killing over 1,800 people, mostly poor residents of New Orleans' historic Black neighborhoods. Katrina was also the U.S.'s costliest natural disaster, causing over $160 billion in damage. Katrina's deadly waters long ago receded, but in their wake, with worsening climate change, the vital lessons of Katrina have gone unheeded. Indeed, President Donald Trump, by flaunting genuine risks, is aggressively courting disaster. Take Trump's attack on FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. In a statement released by the White House in May, FEMA was lumped with a slew of federal agencies that the statement reads represent the, quote, weaponized rot in our federal government, unquote. Targeted agencies included the EPA, the IRS, and the NIH. The document accuses FEMA of being wasteful and woke, engaged in, quote, official training to indoctrinate intersectionality and investment in diversity and inclusion efforts over disaster prevention and response, culminating in aid workers being directed to skip the homes of President Trump's supporters in the wake of a disaster, unquote. As with most of Trump's pronouncements, these accusations are presented without any evidence. The bulk of FEMA's functions, according to Trump, would be delegated to the states. Of course, hurricanes and other natural disasters don't recognize state lines, and no state could single-handedly respond to a disaster of the scale of Hurricane Katrina. Such a response requires collective action, marshaling resources from across the country to save lives in the impacted region, to recover the dead, and to rebuild. Indicative of Trump's contempt for FEMA was his appointment of David Richardson, A former Marine with no experience in disaster recovery is acting head of the agency. Upon his arrival at FEMA, Richardson reportedly shocked staffers by saying he was unaware the U.S. has a hurricane season. A group of current and past FEMA workers published a letter called the Katrina Declaration that they sent to a Trump-appointed FEMA Review Council and to Congress. The letter opens, quote, "Since January 2025, FEMA has been under the leadership of individuals lacking legal qualifications, Senate approval, and the demonstrated background required of a FEMA administrator. Decisions made by David Richardson and Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem hinder the swift execution of our mission and dismiss experienced staff whose institutional knowledge and relationships are vital to ensure effective emergency management," unquote. Close to 200 current and former FEMA workers signed the letter. Most of the current FEMA employees signed anonymously to avoid retaliation. At least 21 of those who did sign their names have been placed on administrative leave. Jeremy Edwards, a former FEMA spokesperson under President Biden, explained why he signed the declaration, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
I would call this letter to Congress, unfortunately, a cry for help. The agency has been badly damaged by this administration. They've fired a third of the permanent workforce. They've cut trainings. They've installed a person at the top of the agency who has no experience.
Edwards also criticized the White House's reassignment of FEMA staff and funding to assist in Trump's mass deportation program.
I think FEMA's mission is very clear, to help people before, during, and after disaster. And any single dollar that isn't being spent to help people with that mission is a failure to the American people. That money should not be going to build immigration detention centers. They should not be sending FEMA personnel, which they are doing, to help onboard new ICE agents.
From the denial of climate science to the gutting of FEMA, to the militarization of American cities with Marines and the National Guard, it seems clear that those in control at the White House have chosen to ignore the devastating lessons of Hurricane Katrina. One person who did learn hard lessons then is Malik Rahim, a longtime resident of the Algiers neighborhood in New Orleans. A co-founder of the New Orleans chapter of the Black Panthers, Rahim organized a grassroots mutual aid effort immediately after Katrina called Common Ground Relief. Democracy Now! Recently caught up with him inside the New Orleans Convention Center, which served as a shelter of last resort for as many as 30,000 desperate city residents during Katrina. When asked about those stranded there, the FEMA director at the time, Michael Brown, famously replied he wasn't aware of the dire conditions there. Those now running roughshod over FEMA should heed Malik Rahim's wise words as the U.S. blunders through another hurricane season.
The sad part about it, it could happen today. Deja vu is alive and well here, because if a hurricane would happen right now, we are ill prepared for it the same way we was ill prepared 20 years ago.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, we'll cut right to an excerpt from All Washed Away by Greg Palast. GregPalast.com has the link to this hour-long thing, and I'm in the middle. It's mostly a discussion with a very well-informed, not at all naive, youthful person named Ethan. I don't know who he is, but he's apparently read all of Palast's work, because he asks a question about Vulture's Picnic, which is a more obscure one of Palast's many works, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is also a film as well from the day. All Washed Away.
And in Texas right now, it's been just over 1 week since the Guadalupe River rose to historic levels, flooding communities just as they were getting ready to celebrate the 4th of July. At least 129 people have died and 166 are still missing. Kerr County was hit the hardest with at least 103 deaths, including 36 children.
The president has talked about potentially eliminating FEMA, but in Texas, he praised the agency's response.
Some good people running FEMA. It's about time, right? We get some good ones. They failed us in North Carolina, but when we got in on January 20th, they fixed it up in no time.
Hello, I'm Ethan Lieberman, here to talk with Greg Palast about his film, Big Easy, Big Outy, and what's happening right now in Texas. Hi, Greg. First question that comes to mind, seemed like Professor Heerden put himself on the line for you in that film.
Boy, did he put himself on the line, to say the least. When our film came out on Democracy Now!, he lost his job. The thing is, he was a tenured professor, so to get rid of him, they closed his entire department. Now, think about this. They closed the hurricane department of Louisiana State University in the Hurricane Center of America just to get rid of Van Heerden. But what they didn't know is that they picked on the wrong guy, because Van Heerden was an anti-apartheid activist in South Africa. In fact, the way he got to Louisiana, he escaped South Africa by building a boat and sailing across the Atlantic to New Orleans to take that job. And so when they fired him, he didn't sit still. He sued the university and won, got his job back, but then he said, "The hell with America. If you want to drown, I'm getting out of here." Now, how did he lose his department? A company called Chevron went after him, because one of the other things that Van Heerden told me on camera was that the reason New Orleans drowned, ultimately, besides all the other horror shows where they didn't care that the levees were too small, that the Bush administration had been informed before the flood they were going to drown. Van Heerden told me that the problem was that the Gulf of Mexico, sorry, it's not the Gulf of America, that the Gulf of Mexico was 100 miles closer to New Orleans than when the city was founded. Because what happened was the oil companies came in, dragged their barges and equipment through the marshes, and eliminated hundreds of miles of protective mangroves. So that when a storm surge hit, bang, there was nothing between the Gulf of Mexico and New Orleans to stop that massive storm surge. And in other words, the real perpetrator was the oil industry. And so Chevron, to shut him down, because he said, "We're going to lose this city again unless you stop the drilling." So Chevron paid for an entirely new department so they could shut down Van Heerden.
So there was a lot in that statement. First of all, the guy packed up and sailed across the Atlantic because he was fed up with our oil companies.
There's more to this story of oil company culpability, and that's why they had to shut him up. Because the oil industry did not like going around through the Mississippi, round and round, to get out to the Gulf Coast with their oil. So they created a canal, a straight line from New Orleans, from the Ninth Ward, all the way out to the Gulf. It was called the Mississippi Gulf Outlet, the MIGO. And all that was a hurricane highway, a shotgun right into the heart of New Orleans. Van Heerden and every hurricane expert said, this is a hurricane highway. If there's a storm surge, you just avoided all of the Mississippi, all the mangroves, and that surge. And when it hit, that 9-foot wall of water just knocked down those levees like nothing. Today, that shotgun facing New Orleans has been plugged up. If it had been plugged up as he demanded and requested before the hurricane, that city would still be alive today. And they took him down. And here's the thing. The U.S. federal courts said that the Army Corps of Engineers, the Bush administration, the U.S. government was responsible and had to rebuild those homes in the Ninth Ward. But that requires an act of Congress to fund the court judgment. And Congress defied that court judgment and never rebuilt the Ninth Ward. Now, at the same time, the houses in the Hamptons and West Hamptons, the multi-million dollar homes, also suffered an Army Corps of Engineers wipeout. And there, the U.S. government rebuilt the multi-million dollar homes of the investment bankers and movie stars in the Hamptons, while they gave the finger to the black folks of the Ninth Ward.
Just like when the markets crash in 08, who gets a bailout but the banks?
Yeah. And we're talking literally a life raft.
Rahim Malik, what happened? Where's his story at?
Well, that was a very uplifting story we had of Malik and the people of the Algiers neighborhood taking that old building, rebuilding it, remodeling it, creating stores for their community. It was one of the great heartwarming stories. And then when the cameras were off, after we left, Malik Rahim and his entire crew and all the residents there were kicked out. And the landlord said, thank you so much for spending millions of dollars and putting in hundreds of thousands of hours of your volunteer time. It's my building now. Get the hell out. And he did that days before Christmas, just to add a little bit.
Another time when it seemed like the people in charge were just trying to rub it in was when they titled the FEMA Relief Village Renaissance Village, as if people were going through a cultural revolution staying in that trailer park.
And I got to tell you that one of the things that happened is because we filmed at Renaissance Village, the FEMA basically prison camp for the, and almost entirely black survivors of Katrina. I was charged and about to be arrested by Homeland Security because they said I was filming critical infrastructure, that is the Exxon refinery. I was a half a mile away from the Exxon refinery just filming the filth that was coming out of those smokestacks that those people in that FEMA park in those disgusting trailers were sucking up those fumes. So the real crime, when Homeland Security tried to arrest me, they said, you know, this is really serious. We've had, you know, terrorists could have used your film to find out where the Exxon refinery is. I said, well, have you ever seen Google Earth? They could give you the exact coordinates. What they didn't want was the film of the poisoning of these refugees from Katrina. I was able to get out of the arrest, the way I know how, which is I screamed bloody murder. So that's why I'm not wearing an orange suit in Guantanamo.
And how about the fate of one of the most notable refugees from the film, Patricia?
Patricia passed away. She had no place, and which often happens with people who are homeless. Now, she was only homeless by government decree. Remember, we went into her house. It was in perfect condition because those beautiful Lafitte homes were on high ground. So they didn't spend the money knocking down the destroyed buildings. Instead, they literally, within short order, tore down the Lafitte homes, tore down Patricia's homes so that they could do exactly what we predicted, that they were turning this into a luxury development to make sure that there was a continuous barrier of upper middle class homes between downtown and the French Quarter. And so Patricia, homeless, brokenhearted, died.
Poignant place to pause that. That's all washed up. Greg Palast in conversation. I wanted to play a little bit more, but I want to get to the other features of the day. You can find that at gregpalast.com. Let's put it away now. All washed up. It's time to go to material about Gaza and all the related issues with both Rashid Holiday and a woman from the NEA. Getting this from Code Pink, episode called Labor in Gaza. First part is with the guy that tried to, Chris Small, tried to organize Amazon workers in warehouses. He actually went on one of the aid boats. I forget what that one was called. Gives me a good opportunity to mention that there's a demo tomorrow up on Prospect and Markview at 6 p.m., there's a gathering before that from 1 to 3 at the Champaign Public Library to make signs, poster making. Hashtag Sail to Gaza Global Samud Flotilla. Samud means aid in the Arabic language, I think. It's a Muslim tradition, if I recall correctly. So that's Rally for Gaza, boat sailing to deliver medicine and food. Chris Small was on the one that was specifically bringing lots of baby food and medical supplies. He was incarcerated for 5 days, and that's at Code Pink. You can find the entirety of it. I'm focusing on the NEA educators for Palestine who are trying to revise some of the teaching. The ADL has a program for teaching, and they're particularly focused on that as not helpful, to put it mildly. Again, Code Pink Radio, podcast, freestanding. If you want to hear the whole thing,
I'm Marcy Winograd. With me today is Mary Najimy. She is the former president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, a co-founder of Massachusetts Rank and File for Palestine, and a co-founder of the Caucus Educators for Palestine and the National Education Association, the largest teachers union and the largest union in the country with 3 million members. So welcome, Mary.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here and talk about this monumental accomplishment that we had inside of the NEA.
Exactly. So just to sum up, the NEA rank and file, we have about 7,000 delegates in that union, voted for a motion that said the NEA will not partner with the Anti-Defamation League for curriculum or professional development, given its history of surveillance and opposition to groups fighting for social justice and to end racism. And yet, on the heels of that, we hear that the president of the union, Becky Pringle, the executive committee, the 9 members, and the entire board, which has over 100 people, voted to not implement that. So I'm wondering how you see that, what your response is, and just what your overall response is to the excitement that this campaign has generated.
Right. It's certainly the vote of the board to reverse the democratically made decision, the vote of the representative assembly has infuriated, the overwhelming number of people who actually voted in favor of this new business item. And within that, however, the leadership did learn some important things. If you look at President Pringle's statement, she actually shows that what she learned was that the ADL is an organization that suppresses speech and attacks Palestinians and other BIPOC and anti-Zionist Jewish members. And she acknowledged that in her statement by calling on the ADL to support free speech. She strongly condemned them and used words like their aberrant and unacceptable attacks on our members. But the leadership still hasn't fully understood what the manifestations of anti-Palestinian racism are. And they're not able to see the ADL's actions through that lens. But you know what? What matters more, Marcy, is the passage in the first place of this new business item, because it represents a sea change in people's understanding of who the Palestinians are and what their struggle is. It shows that the rank and file of the NEA, and actually the rank and file of many of the state affiliates, is calling for a new position with inside the NEA, supporting Palestinian rights, opposing the normalization of support for Israel in general, and also in K-12 education. And it has broken the facade of the ADL, and we've exposed the harm that ADL is causing, and there's no going back from there. So that's the real victory.
So let's talk about that. You say the harm of the ADL. I've closely looked at their lesson plans, at their curriculum, which includes A World of Difference, No Place for Hate, Echoes and Reflections, and now in California is officially part of a state-sanctioned teachers collaborative to provide professional development for teachers. So it's important that we look very closely at what they are saying. And here's what they're saying. In Echoes and Reflections, the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, has a whole unit on contemporary anti-Semitism, which they clearly equate with criticism of Israel, to silence dissent. And in fact, they have a whole article on how peace activists are aligned with extremists. And we know that they had a history of suing school districts and colleges, and they boast about that. And they include on their website articles attacking Jewish Voice for Peace, one of the fastest growing Jewish organizations, an anti-Zionist organization of which I am a member. So it's troubling to think that a teachers' union would be promoting attacks on a Jewish organization, promoting attacks on peace activists, or rubber stamping propaganda to shield Israel during a genocide.
Right, right. And this is one of the reasons why we, you know, Educators for Palestine has actually been highly successful in the last couple of years. It was because Educators for Palestine that the NEA finally came out and called for a ceasefire with the whole National Labor Network, that they called for an arms embargo. We actually last year on the floor of this representative assembly, which is like a giant town hall meeting, passed a new business item that they would teach about the Nakba. So the ADL, in addition to all of the problematic things that you just listed about the curriculum, has several other problematic elements to it. And it's just our job to continue to educate the NEA and rank and file members. So they consistently commit acts of anti-Palestinian racism by dehumanizing Palestinian people, pushing to erase and censor the Palestinian narratives like you just described, falsely conflating the criticism of Zionism and the State of Israel with anti-Semitism. But there's also more than that. They have a long and sordid history of surveilling the Palestinian Liberation Movement, the South African anti-apartheid movement of the 80s and 90s, Zionist Jews who participated in either or both. A third thing, they sponsor municipal police to take trips to Israel to learn anti-terrorism policing tactics. And we saw that manifest for the first time in Ferguson. And now we see it pervasive in how police Black and Brown communities. Fourth, their racist attacks extend beyond the Palestinian and Jewish community. They attack Black, Indigenous, and queer people, mostly for intersectional organizing. And finally, they're just not a reliable source for civil rights data or anti-Semitism data. There are actually Jewish scholars and Jewish news sources have pointed out their reliance on vague reports, lack of verification, and then the conflation of these weighty anti-Semitic issues that are real with these sort of trivial incidences or incidences that are about the criticism of Israel. So it's for all of those reasons, not just the curriculum, that we're forcing this into the light and wanting NEA to take a stand.
Mary, as coordinator of the Drop the ADL campaign at Code Pink, I just am so grateful to you and to the other rank and file activists who have campaigned to drop the ADL. And regardless of what anti-democratic moves are made by the board or the president of this 3 million member union, the rank and file knows what's happening. I mean, you can't unsee what you have seen. And we have seen the ADL, initially at least, defend the Trump administration's arrest of Mahmoud Khalil, the Palestinian leader at Columbia. We have seen the ADL on television compare keffiyehs, a symbol of Palestinian liberation, a scarf that Palestinian farmers wore with swastikas. This is outrageous. We should not be promoting the ADL in our schools. And so my message to those who are listening, if you are involved in schools, if you're a parent, if you're a teacher, an educator, a taxpayer, make your views known. If you feel compelled to communicate with your local school district, that they should not be promoting the ADL, partnering with any of their curriculum or professional development. Now, Mary, let's talk for a minute. And I also want to congratulate you on passing that Nakba resolution. Some people may not know the Nakba is the Arabic term for catastrophe of the 1947-48 ethnic cleansing of Palestine, when Zionist terrorists were burning villages to the ground, burning olive groves, erasing Palestinian history, and imposing a Jewish state, an ethno-nationalist state on historic Palestine, expelling, 750,000 to a million Palestinians never allowed to return. They may not know that history, but you passed that resolution. So that's going to be fascinating to see teachers teach about the Nakba, which I absolutely applaud. I mean, I think we have to talk about the Holocaust, the murder of 6 million Jews, 11 million people total during the Nazis' Third Reich. But we also need to talk about the Nakba. So your thoughts about how that might unfold?
Yeah, I think we're in a new moment where we have to recognize that a genocide takes many different forms. It has unfolded over many centuries throughout history. And we can no longer exceptionalize one over any other, right? We have to, if we always say, the Palestinian Solidarity Movement always says, the struggle for Palestinian liberation is not a zero-sum game. Right now, the state of Israel has made it a zero-sum game that Israelis have to win at the expense of Palestinians. But what Palestinians and all of us in solidarity with them, including a large swath of Jewish people around the country and the world, is that our liberation is inextricably linked to each other, right? And so part of our, this is also part of the work of Liberated Ethnic Studies, which the ADL also attacks, because Liberated Ethnic Studies compels people to look at systems and structures of oppression, occupation, colonization, and the ADL does not want Israel to be lumped in with that. So our job as educators is to continue to educate ourselves, each other, on how to teach in the context of a racial solidarity framework, and recognizing, you know, I don't know what the future curriculum would be, but my hope is we can look at what are the standards of genocide, the agreed upon international standards of genocide, and how do we help children look at what's happening in Palestine and critique what's happening to the Palestinians in Gaza, what Israel is imposing against those 10 criteria. It's not our job to tell them how to think. It's our job to teach them how to analyze events historically today against standards and criteria that the world has set.
Agreed.
That's from Code Pink Radio, available as a podcast, as I mentioned. That's Marcy Winograd, the host, and a woman who is in the NEA. She's co-founder of a group, Educators for Palestine, Mary Najimi, I think is how it's said, talking about how rank-and-file teachers are rejecting the Anti-Defamation League's curriculum and training that conflates criticism of Israel genocide with anti-Semitism. It also features Chris Smalls, co-founder of the Amazon Labor Union, which didn't get a contract, lamentably, who was also on a Freedom Flotilla carrying aid to the coast of Palestine. Of course, it was pirated at high seas or off the coast, and he spent 5 days in an Israeli jail where he was beaten. And that's for episode is 314, Labor for Palestine, from Code Bank Radio. Going to go on to Law and Disorder excerpt. Again, I did play this last week on my other show, Window on the World, but I thought it was a good follow-on since includes Rashid Holiday talking about why he's completely quitting Columbia. He's emeritus. He was going to teach a class, but he can't teach it the way he wants. He promises to do a YouTube version sometime in the future, maybe late November, October. So that'll be something interesting. 100-year century-long war or something like that is this book. That was the one that the book that somehow former President Biden was carrying at a bookstore on Martha's Vineyard or something like that, which I can't remember, was after he was no longer a candidate, but yeah, it was a good photo op maybe for some people, but I don't know that he read it. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Here's Heidi Boghossian and Michael Smith interviewing or conversing with Rashid Holiday.
The goals of the MAGA movement at which they've been largely successful, has been to dominate relations over the major institutions of our society, including the mass media, the Supreme Court, independent government agencies, major law firms, the Congress, and most lately, the large private universities such as Harvard and Brown and Columbia. We speak today with returning guest, retired Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi. For over two decades, he held the Edward Said Chair of Middle Eastern History. He's the author of numerous books, including most recently, The 100 Years' War Against Palestine. Although retired, he had been scheduled to teach his longstanding popular class on Middle Eastern history. After Columbia University capitulated to the Trump administration with respect to the administration taking over the university, Professor Khalidi was no longer able to teach his class in an honest, unfettered fashion. We speak with him today about the situation and his open letter denouncing the perfidy of acting Columbia University President Carol Shipman in her school's capitulation. We put this into historical context. Professor Rashid Khalidi, a hearty welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Rashid, what has the Israeli army done to the people of Gaza, and why has it been able to get away with it?
Well, what it has done essentially is to destroy the entire physical and social infrastructure of the Gaza Strip, immiserating and repeatedly displacing over 2 million people and killing and maiming untold tens of thousands. The number of killed and wounded is well over 200,000. It may be more. It's well over 10% of the population of the Gaza Strip. At the same time, they have been moving them around the Gaza Strip, forcing them from one area into another, with the stated goal of expelling as many of them as possible from the Gaza Strip. So this is a campaign of genocide and ethnic cleansing decided by a sovereign government and which the Israeli army is carrying out faithfully. It's able to do this only because it has the support of the United States and of other Western governments, which supply it with money, arms, diplomatic support, and propaganda support through the complicit corporate media.
Is this truth starting to come out, and will it help them?
It's not only starting to come out, it's completely changed public opinion in Europe and the United States. Historically, Israel has always enjoyed massive popular and elite support in the United States and Western Europe, and that is not the case today. According to the latest polls, over 60% of Americans disapprove of what Israel is doing in Gaza, want the war to stop, disapprove of the United States arming Israel. You've never had numbers like that in the history, not only of Israel, of the whole Zionist project. The numbers in Europe are even more damning. A YouGov poll a couple months ago showed support for Israel in the low 20% range in the United Kingdom, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and Denmark. That's never been the case in history, that Israel has not enjoyed majority support from public opinion. Elites have not changed as much or at all, but public opinion has shifted massively, significantly, and I think in some respects, perhaps permanently.
Rashid, was this genocide foretold? Chris Hedges says it was, and in fact, that's the title of his new book, Genocide Foretold. What's your opinion on that?
Every settler colonial project has to either eliminate or, at the very least, completely subjugate and neutralize the indigenous population, or it loses. Those are the only two options. The latter is what happened in Algeria and a number of other countries. The settler colonial projects were defeated. That's what happened in Ireland. The project was defeated because they could not either utterly eliminate or, in the case of Algeria, Ireland, and countries like Kenya and South Africa, completely subjugate the population. In North America, in Australasia, the other outcome is what we saw. And this is the problem that Zionism has in Palestine. They have not succeeded after over 100 years since Herzl wrote his famous book in 1897, The Jewish State. They have not succeeded in completely subjugating the Palestinians, and they haven't eliminated them, and they haven't driven them out of the country. The majority of the population under Israeli rule today is still Arab by a small number, but there's still more Arabs than there are Jews between the river and the sea, which is the territory of the state of Israel right now. Was that foretold? It's in the logic of this project. This specific genocide, I don't think, was foretold, the specific nature of it. Not necessarily, no. But was something like this inevitable and necessary? Yes. That's the nature of settler colonialism.
Rashid, why and how did the United States facilitate the genocide in Israel?
The United States has been the main backer of this project. It's been a backer of this project since Woodrow Wilson, but it's been the main backer since the foundation of the State of Israel. And that support has increased over time. It was much more limited in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s. But from mid-1960s onwards, the United States became the main patron of Israel, protecting it and otherwise supplying it with everything necessary for it to subjugate the Palestinians. The weapons that Israel uses are, the major weapon systems, Every single combat warplane, F-15, F-16, F-35, is American. Every single major combat helicopter is American. Most of the missiles those helicopters fire are American. I could go on and on and on. So this is just one example. There are hundreds of millions, probably billions of dollars that go to Israel tax-free as so-called charitable deductions from 501c3s that fund a whole range of institutions in Israeli society, but fund the settlement project, for example. And finally, the American taxpayer generously contributes $3.8 billion a year, plus another $15 billion that have been contributed by the American taxpayer willingly or unwillingly since this war began. So the United States pays for arms and diplomatically protects this genocide, without which it would not be able to go on. They wouldn't have the weapons, they wouldn't have the money, they wouldn't have the diplomatic protection. Israel is a pariah state in most of the world. You have dock workers refusing to unload their cargo. You have tourist destinations refusing to allow their tourists to land. You have a worldwide revulsion such that Israel would probably be booted out of the United Nations, as it may be deserves to have happened to it, but for the United States. There are other sponsors, Britain, France, Germany, other Western countries. But the main reason that this genocide has been possible is because of unremitting American support.
Professor Rashid Khalidi, you were scheduled to give a course at Columbia University subsequent to your retirement from that place, but recently you withdrew. Can you tell our audience why you withdrew?
Yes, I retired from Columbia in the summer of 2024, at the end of a three-year phased retirement agreement, whereby I was permitted, if my department wanted me to teach a course. And I did teach a course, in fact, in the fall semester after I retired, my big modern Middle East lecture course, which annually has between 250 and 300 students. And I was scheduled to teach that course this fall. Then in March, the Trump administration issued its ultimatum to Columbia, which agreed in principle very soon afterwards. I wrote a scathing editorial in The Guardian about that last March. And in June, at the end of June, a little more than a month and a half ago, Columbia came to a final agreement with the Trump administration, according to which several measures were put in place, which in my view made the teaching of modern Middle East history, and actually much else, impossible. One of these was the adoption by Columbia of the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, whereby most criticisms, or many criticisms of Israel and Zionism, are considered anti-Semitism, which is an absurdity, but that's been accepted by the university, among which were the appointment of a senior vice provost to supervise Middle East and area studies. Remit undetermined, but the intention is clear. And finally, the imposition of a government monitor chosen by Colombia and the government from a firm that, by the way, celebrated Israel back in June at a ceremony that they organized. So we know what kind of monitor this is going to be, with quite unrestricted remit as far as the ability to look into what happens in the classroom, what happens in departments, and so on and so forth. In light of these newly accepted conditions, at the end of June, a few weeks ago. And in light of the acceptance by Colombia of the canard, of the mendacious lie that Colombia as an institution is historically anti-Semitic, it has been for many, many years, in light of the incredible disciplinary kangaroo courts that have been instituted by Colombia in violation of all of the procedures that have been laid down since 1968, and in light of the penalties that were handed down to some of my colleagues, and in particular to many, many students, dozens of whom were expelled, dozens of whom were suspended, many of whom had their degrees either withdrawn or withheld, I realized that Colombia had turned into a sort of an academic police state, and that the target, or the ostensible target of this, was anyone or anybody critical of Israel, critical of Zionism. I mean, there are many other targets. They have targets in the areas of race and gender that they're going to be working on. But the primary target, the ostensible reason for all of this, was the supposed inveterate anti-Semitism of Colombia, which is simply a translation for an attitude critical of Israel and its genocide in Gaza, which is what the gatekeepers at Columbia, the people who run the place, are trying to prevent at all costs. What I realized was that the teaching of Middle East history generally and the kinds of topics that I cover in this course, things like the Nakba of 1948, the forced expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians from their homes by Israel before, during, and after the 1948 war, as well as other topics such as the Armenian Genocide, were impossible to teach under these new regulations. And with these new draconian disciplinary procedures that have been instituted.
Rashid, just recently, Columbia President Claire Shipman said with a straight face about the deal she did with Trump that, quote, Columbia retains control over its academic and operational decisions. Your reaction to that, please.
Claire Shipman is being, at best, disingenuous. I mean, you merely have to read the text of the agreement that they made with the government a little over a month ago to see that a government-imposed monitor the very existence of a government-imposed monitor to look into this broad range of things that are described in the agreement, with vast powers to access data, to attend meetings, to interfere in a variety of respects, means that some element of Columbia's control over its academic and operational decisions has been compromised. I mean, you either listen to and believe Claire Shipman, or you listen or you look at and understand the agreement that she signed. The two are not compatible.
Is the censorship and repression at Columbia part of a larger effort to bring into line other entities in the United States, like the big law firms, the courts, the scientific establishment, the media, and put them under control of an autocratic president?
I mean, that's exactly what is happening. This is an attempt on the part of the Trump administration to bring to heel every institution, independent institution in society, which is capable of marshaling a criticism of this president's policies and actions. And it's part of the playbook, the textbook, for democratic governments that are sliding into autocracy and dictatorship. We're not there yet, but that's the direction we're going. When you think about how a Chile or how a Hungary or how a Turkey or how Russia at the beginning of before Putin's rule slowly took control of these institutions which are capable of an independent critique, academia, the media, the courts, law firms, and so forth, you see that this is the autocrat's playbook. It's being done in the American case in many institutions, at least in the case of Columbia and Harvard and some other universities, in the name of a combat against anti-Semitism. But what it's really about is to bring to heel independent institutions, which are the only obstacle in a democratic society, to the kind of one-man rule that Trump is obviously moving towards and has already, in fact, in some respects, begun to exercise.
This is Attorney Michael Smith at Law & Disorder Radio. I'm speaking with our guest, Professor Rashid Khalidi, on the situation in the Middle East, and specifically the more general situation about what's going on in the United States. Rashid, at the University of Wisconsin, where I went to school, in 1894, economics professor Richard Ely was pursued by business interests after voicing support for workers who were out on strike. He was a socialist. At that point, he received the support of the Board of Regents at the university, who issued an historic statement proclaiming that, quote, "Whatever may be the limitations that trample upon knowledge elsewhere, we at the great state University of Wisconsin believe in the continual and fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth may be found." By way of contrast, Columbia University gave in to the demands of the Trump administration, as you so eloquently wrote in your open letter to the president of Columbia, Claire Shipman. How have things changed in our capitalist society in the last 150 years to explain Columbia's capitulation to Trump and his MAGA group and its oligarchical allies?
Well, I think that we're in another era of oligarchy. We were back in the 1890s, and the extraordinary thing is that there were institutions within American society that stood up to those oligarchies, that stood up to those who would, in this case, smash unions and silence anyone who defended workers' right to strike. We've gone through periods like this in American history. The Palmer Raids period, the period when so many immigrants were deported, the period when racist immigration laws were instituted at the end of World War I and into the early 1920s, was a similar period. And American capitalism has changed over time from the 1890s, the era of the great railway barons and other oligarchs. We've moved into an era of even greater concentration of capital, and an era where the tight links between political power and wealth have been further cemented by the legalized bribery system of American elections, whereby whoever pays the most has the most influence on a politician and ultimately on policy. And we're seeing this with the Trump administration, with the dismantling of environmental regulations at the behest of the oil industry, the dismantling of other regulations at the behest of other industries. So I think that we are in an era of even greater concentration of capital. And I mean, this was symbolized by the brief reign of Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, was running a large chunk of the American government for a few months there. I don't think you've ever had anything quite as blatant as that in American history, for all the power of wealth within this system from its very beginnings. I mean, the founders and framers, they were all wealthy men, with very few exceptions. And that's true of the political class and the elite in the United States to this day. It's made up of very, very wealthy individuals.
Rashid, you've promised that you're going to offer a lecture online instead of the lecture you were given at Columbia. Can you tell our audience more about this, please?
When I decided I couldn't teach at Columbia, I cast about for an alternative, and I decided that what I would do was to give a series of lectures. In particular, I'm not going to give the same lectures that I would have given in my modern Middle East history course. What I'm going to do is to give what I'm going to call a short course on Palestine, and I will do that at a venue in New York called the People's Forum, a venue in Manhattan, in Chelsea. The course will be free. The course will be hybrid, so most people will be able to access it online. I believe it'll be streamed, and I hope it'll later on be available. And this, I don't know how many lectures exactly. They may be five or a half dozen, or maybe a few more over a period of several weeks. I'm still working on the syllabus. I mean, I made these decisions a week ago, but that's the framework. The course will be free, but donations will be accepted for rebuilding the universities of Gaza. The American Academy, that is to say, American universities, by and large, have protected Israel's genocide by mercilessly cracking down on the students who oppose that genocide. And they have thereby taken the side of the people who are destroying, have destroyed systematically every single university in Gaza. Not one peep has emerged from the mouth of one spokesperson or one leader of one American university about the annihilation of the universities that served over 2 million people. It's a disgrace that American academia will take a long time to live down. So the money that we'll get from book sales and the money that people voluntarily contribute, whether in person or online, will go, it'll be a small amount, unfortunately, but it will go towards the rebuilding of the universities of Gaza.
So Rashid, if you were the president of Columbia University and you were in Claire Shipman's position, what would you have done and said?
Well, I think the problem is that the issue is that the problem goes back a lot further than Claire Shipman's brief tenure as acting president. She's the third president that Columbia has had in 3 years. The tenure of each one of them was very brief, and none of them have distinguished themselves, unfortunately. The problem goes back to a narrative that was established by powerful off-campus interests, allied with very few students and a very few faculty members, but that was picked up by a large element of the donor class and a large element of the Board of Trustees, which is that Columbia was anti-Semitic. I mean, a member of the Board of Trustees made his very large donation conditional on Columbia proving it was not anti-Semitic. That person is still deeply involved in the administration of Columbia University, as are many other senior members of the Board of Trustees, the dominant faction of the Board of Trustees. That is a mendacious, false narrative. Columbia is not and has never been institutionally anti-Semitic. What they are outraged at is that there is criticism of Israel. And it's criticism of Israel, which is shared by large majorities of students and faculty. And there's proof of this. There was a vote on the part of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences of no confidence in President Chafee for her handling of the on-campus situation. A large majority, over two-thirds, of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences voted no confidence in President Chafee. Similarly, even before this war started, large majorities at both Columbia College and Barnard College, of Columbia undergraduates and Barnard undergraduates, voted for Columbia to divest from companies that supported the Israeli occupation. That's the majority of students, and that's the majority, at least of arts and sciences faculty. The professional schools are in a different category. And many of the senior professional school faculty ascribe to this false, mendacious narrative of anti-Semitism, simply because of their blind adherence to an Israel-first approach. They believe that Israel can do no wrong, and they believe any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, and they have imposed this narrative on the university. When you start from that position, this is not an assault on the university from without. This is an assault on the university from without for reasons that have to do with Trump's agenda, which is being supported by a fifth column within. Those are the people who brought down Columbia University, the trustees, the senior faculty members, the donors, the administrators, who subscribed to this utterly false narrative that because people criticize Israel, they are anti-Semites. I mean, a very large proportion of the faculty and a very large proportion of the student body are Jewish and were bitterly opposed to what Israel was doing in Gaza. Two-thirds of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences included a very large proportion of the Jewish faculty. The overwhelming majorities in Columbia College and Barnard and other undergraduate units of the university were Jewish students. So this idea that this is a university that is rife with Jew hatred is absolutely absurd. But it is subscribed to by the Board of Trustees now, by Columbia University officially. I mean, you read Shipman's statements. It's all about combating anti-Semitism at Columbia in line with the tune being played by the Trump administration, which, as we've already talked about, has its own objectives that have actually nothing to do with anti-Semites. The idea that an administration that's rife with anti-Semites should really care about anti-Semitism is utterly absurd.
And Columbia has issued a unfair labor practice against the union there, too. So how about that on Labor Day weekend? Thanks for listening. Labor Radio Free Labor coming up straight away. Let's do a little business with an underwriting announcement. I mentioned again, there's a rally, hashtag sale to Gaza, up on Prospect and Market View tomorrow at 6. There's a gathering at the Champaign Public Library to make signs in advance of that from 1 to 3. If you're interested, opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Here's a short underwriting announcement, and then we'll kick Radio Free Labor. Stick around.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's E-L-L-I-O-T-T, Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.